Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 346 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's podcast, I'll be going over something that is very high yield for step 2, CK step 3, and that is cardiovascular pharmacology. So the thing is, the USMLE step 2, CK and step 3 exams both test cardiovascular pharmacology, but they have a somewhat different focus compared to step 1. So that step 2 CK, step 3 focus is what I'm going to be detailing in this podcast. And that's very likely what I'm going to be doing as well in the next podcast. It's not something I can cover in one podcast. So this is definitely going to be a 2 or 3 podcast series. But if you listen to these podcasts, you'll feel very comfortable with this material. And pretty much, at least that's what I'm trying to achieve to the best of my abilities. If you know and understand what is in this podcast and the next podcast, then any cardio pharmacology question you get on your exam with very high degree of certainty, you'll get it right. Again, I'm not going to say 100%, but I'm going to get you pretty close to 100%. And the thing is, this podcast, the goal is not going to be to give you a bunch of stuff to memorize. Again, don't get me wrong. There's going to be information to memorize for sure. But I'm going to make a very strong attempt to explain pathophysiology so that you actually really understand why certain things are a certain way. So I encourage you to just come on this journey with me, and I think you're going to have a very fun ride. I really like a cardiopharm. So if cardiopharm has been something that, I really struggle with this thing, I am really praying that your troubles will be over after this podcast. Now, before I get into it, just a quick housekeeping thing. If you're taking the USMLE Step 2 CK or Step 3 exams, anytime within November, December, I will strongly encourage you to attend the course I offer. It's a Step 2 CK, Step 3 review course. It starts off with a test-taking strategies course on the 1st of November. That's from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And then it continues as a 24-hour review course. It's 24 hours total. It begins on the 2nd of November and runs to the 5th of November. It's from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. In the course, we go over it's now actually more than 2,000 scenarios roughly across internal medicine, psychiatry, surgery, pediatrics, OB-GYN, neurology, biostatistics, ethics, communications, healthcare systems. We go over some key screening guidelines, go over some key vaccines, go over infectious diseases. We go over multi-system processes and disorders. And then we also have like a triggers section where we go over a host of things that are just very high yield associations to know for the exam. Again, I've had many people, I get emails every week. I've had many people attend these courses and they've done really well on their exams. I don't know if I'm going to be able to hold a course in December. But for sure, God willing, I'm going to be holding a course in November. So if you're taking your exam in November or December, and it doesn't matter where you are, beginning of your dedicated period, middle of your dedicated period, end of your dedicated period. I've even had people take these courses 2 days before the exam, and they found it to be very beneficial. So again, if that's something you're interested in, shoot me an email through the website, and I'll give you some more information and details. But again, I promise you, it will be definitely worth your while. It's a course that's held over Zoom. Again, I've had many people take it and do really well. It will absolutely, absolutely be worth your while. The test-taking strategies course will teach you about test-taking processes, but the review course will teach you content, and it's going to teach you that content in context. At least you've listened to my podcast. You know that I'm not very big on just, again, giving you information to memorize. You understand why things are a certain way, but I will highlight it to you the way the MBME is going to test it on an exam. Okay, so let's get right into this podcast. So what if they give you a question about a young guy and they tell you that for the last 2 hours, he has been having very severe palpitations. And then he comes to the emergency room and they tell you that his heart rate is like 210 beats per minute, right? And then they don't even give you many clues beyond that. So let's say it's just some guy that's like 25 years old. And then they say, what's your next best step in management? Well, I would really hope that you're saying to go ahead and give this guy procainamide, right? Go ahead and give this guy procainamide. This guy has Wolff Parkinson White. Right? Wolff Parkinson White is not going to be an old person's problem on your exam. It's going to be a young person's problem. If a person is like 50 something years old or whatever, you need some very strong reasons to say, oh, I think this person has WPW on the test. And the thing is, sometimes our friends at the NBMEs, instead of putting the term WPW, here's what they will do. They will call it a supraventricular tachycardia, because WPW is in fact supraventricular tachycardia, right? And remember, on an EKG, you're going to find that classically described delta wave, right? But again, what do our smart friends at the NBMEs do these days? Instead of calling it a delta wave, they will tell you that, oh, EKG shows a short PR interval plus a wide QRS complex. I'll say that again, a short PR interval plus a wide QRS complex. If you see that, you absolutely want to think about WPW. That is just them describing the delta wave to you. And newsflash, for those of you that are taking the USMLEs, I will encourage you, especially step 2 CK, step 3, you know, more recent times, you should pretty much not expect any buzzwords. That is something that is becoming more and more extinct on the exam. These days, the NBMEs are very big on descriptions. That's why sometimes I almost feel like, again, no one can say this for sure, but I almost feel like they do this because of the renewed push towards using Anki in medical education. Anki is amazing. But again, I feel like many people use Anki wrongly. They just blindly memorize facts. They can blindly do closed deletions. But the actual understanding they don't have, right? So the thing is, I'm telling you, if you're studying for these exams, as you're memorizing those buzzwords, make sure you understand, like, what in the world do these buzzwords mean? Because you can get in hot water very quickly. I'm telling you this, the NBMEs are almost like a descriptive buzzword test. They just describe everything, even in the answer choices, right? Again, instead of putting Kawasaki's disease, just put mucocutaneous lymph node syndrome, right? So again, those are things you just have to get used to. I'm telling you this, not as, oh, wow, Divine took his USMLEs years ago. No. I tutor many people that take these exams every single week, right? So again, I will encourage you, make sure you're not just memorizing, but you're actually understanding what you're trying to memorize. Okay, right? So this guy has WPW, right? So WPW, again, is treated with procainamide, right? So what's the big thing to know about procainamide for step 2 CK, step 3? Remember, procainamide is an antiarrhythmic. It's a sodium channel blocker, right? It's a class 1A antiarrhythmic, very high yield. It is a class 1A antiarrhythmic, right? So procainamide is the drug of choice for WPW. And the thing is, if a person has AFib with WPW, because many of us are used to, oh, if a person has AFib, put them on a beta blocker or a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker like verapamil or diltiazem. You cannot do that if they have AFib with WPW. The drug of choice for AFib with WPW is going to be procainamide. And remember, procainamide is a drug that you just give in the acute phase of WPW. It's not a drug that you place people on long-term. Right? In general, if you want good long-term treatment of WPW, the smart thing you're supposed to do on an NBM exam is to ablate those pathways, right? This is something that's usually done by an electrophysiologist. They're going to go ahead and ablate those pathways, and that's how you're going to go ahead and treat Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome. Now, remember, what if they tell you that, okay, this person is studying on Wolff-Parkinson-White, person started on procainamide, and then they tell you that, oh, well, they notice that after a few days, he starts complaining of joint pain. He has like a rash on his face. He starts having pain whenever he takes a deep breath, like signs of serositis. If you see all these things, I want you to think of drug-induced lupus, right? I want you to absolutely think of drug-induced lupus. Remember, drug-induced lupus is associated with antihistone antibodies, right? And procainamide is one of those drugs that can cause drug-induced lupus. What are the other drugs that can cause drug-induced lupus you need to know for exams? Well, remember things like sulfonamides, remember hydralazine, remember isoniazid, right? Remember phenytoin, remember procainamide, remember the TNF inhibitor, etanercept. Remember, etanercept is not a monoclonal antibody. It's actually like a decoy receptor for tumor necrosis factor. Right. So again, don't forget the drugs that cause drug-induced lupus: sulfonamides, hydralazine, isoniazid, procainamide, phenytoin, and etanercept. Right. Those are high yield ones to know for exams. And it's also very high yield to know that this drug-induced lupus is something that we find in people that are slow acetylators. Right. Let me tell you this. I mean, obviously, you can find it in people that are not slow acetylators, but it's very common on NBM exams in people that are slow acetylators, right? Again, I know you may say like, Divine, no one really cares about this fact. Trust me, you should really care about this fact. This is one of these bizarre questions that pop up on the exam. Everybody will get it wrong. You don't have to be one of those people because you are paying attention, right? So remember, slow acetylators, because the thing is, these drugs, especially like procainamide, they are metabolized, right, by acetylation, right? So the thing is, if a person is a slow acetylator, right, they can begin to have problems with metabolizing procainamide properly, right? So that slow versus fast acetylator paradigm, it's one of these things that biostatistically, it shows up in a bimodal distribution, right? Bimodal distribution, right? Obviously, on one end of the distribution are going to be the slow acetylators. On the other end of the distribution are going to be the fast acetylators. Remember, that kind of same concept operates with people that have Hodgkin's lymphoma, right? Hodgkin's lymphoma shows up in like young, very young people, and also shows up in adults, right? People around the age of 50s, right? Those things that illustrate the biostatistical concept of bimodality in general end up being pretty high yield on the exam. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient is hemodynamically unstable, right? And they tell you that, oh, you see an EKG, you notice they have a white complex regular tachyarrhythmia, right? So the person is hemodynamically stable. Let me not say unstable. Let me say hemodynamically stable. And then you get an EKG, you see a white complex regular tachyarrhythmia, right? Again, what arrhythmia does this person have to start? I really hope you're saying, oh, divine, it sounds like this person has VTAC, right? This person has ventricular tachycardia, right? So what's the big thing to know about this person? Well, let me break some things down for you. We see it's a wide complex. When something's a wide complex arrhythmia, it's a ventricular arrhythmia. That's set in stone. And then when you see the term that, oh, this thing is a regular tachyarrhythmia, then that should pretty much go ahead and tell you that, oh, the spaces between the QRS complexes are completely equal, right? The spaces between the QRS complexes are equal, right? So that's one good thing to know there. So wide complex regular tachyarrhythmia, right? This person has VTAC. Now, this person has VTAC and they're hemodynamically stable. The person has VTAC and they're hemodynamically stable. I really hope you're saying, okay, divine, looks like the next drug we're going to be giving these people is amiodarone, right? Amiodarone. Amiodarone is the drug of choice for treating hemodynamically stable VTAC, right? Amiodarone is the drug of choice for treating hemodynamically stable VTAC on NBME exams. Again, the thing is, are there some exceptions to this rule? Absolutely. But those exceptions, the NBME largely does not care about those, right? So VTAC, hemodynamically stable, you're going to do amiodarone. Remember, if you're unstable with VTAC, you're going to be getting synchronized cardioversion. And then if you have no pulse and you have VTAC, you're going to be getting unsynchronized cardioversion. That's essentially another term for defibrillation. If you want to learn more about all these ACLS algorithms, check out episode 104. It's basically an ACLS podcast. If you listen to that podcast, pretty much everything you need to know about ACLS for your USMLE exams, you're going to find in that podcast. So how does amiodarone work? So the thing is, amiodarone, primarily, it's a potassium channel blocker. It's a class 3 antiarrhythmic, right? It's a potassium channel blocker. It's a class 3 antiarrhythmic. But to be honest with you, amiodarone does many other things. It's also it also blocks sodium channels. It also has some beta blocking activity. It's just a very ubiquitous drug. It's a pretty awesome drug, but it has a lot of side effects, right? It has a lot of side effects. And remember, besides VTAC in a person that is hemodynamically stable, another thing we can use amiodarone for is we can use it in AFib. We can use it as part of a rhythm control strategy in the management of AFib, right? The chronic management of AFib. Because remember, people that have AFib, they can pursue one of two treatment strategies. They can have a rate control strategy where you can use a beta blocker, or you can use a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker like verapamil or diltiazem. But alternatively, you can also use rhythm control strategy where you're actually trying to avoid the arrhythmia chemically with amiodarone, right? Amiodarone can be used in those circumstances, right? Although rate control, I'll say this, rate control is more often used on NBME exams than rhythm control, right? Rate control is more often used on NBME exams than rhythm control. Now, the thing is, amiodarone, look at the name, amiodarone, right? Iodo, it has iodo in the name, right? That's iodine, right? You probably remember this from, I don't know, high school, college. I know certainly we used to do some of these experiments back in the day in Nigeria with starch. We will add iodine and then it will change the starch, turning blue, right? The thing is, starch obviously is a carbohydrate. There's lots of carbs in your skin. So the thing is, amiodarone likes to discolor things just because of the iodine it contains, right? So it can discolor your cornea, right? People, they can have like almost like this whisker-like physical exam finding with your cornea. Again, it's just from discoloration, right? Amiodarone can also cause like discoloration of the skin, right? It can cause blue skin discoloration. Now, remember, amiodarone is metabolized in the liver,
right? So if your liver doesn't work, you should not be on amiodarone, right? That's just a simple thing to know for your exams. And then remember, what if they tell you that a person has been on amiodarone, right? And then the person starts having, you know, over a 6 month period, they start having like, you know, progressively worsening shortness of breath, exercise intolerance, and they tell you that, oh, you're listening to these people's lungs and you're hearing crackles. If you think about that, I want you to think of pulmonary fibrosis, right? Pulmonary fibrosis. Remember, amiodarone absolutely can cause pulmonary fibrosis, right? That's one of the big things you want to keep in mind on the exams, right? So it's going to cause pulmonary fibrosis. That's going to show up as a restrictive lung disease. FEV1 to FVC ratio will be normal or slightly increased, right? And in those cases, the DLCO will be decreased, right? Because again, you're making the ability of oxygen to diffuse across the alveolar membrane a lot more difficult, right? A lot more difficult. And remember, amiodarone can cause both hypo or hyperthyroidism, right? Because again, it contains iodine, right? So you can take advantage of either the Wolff-Chaikoff effect or the Yod-Bisdal phenomenon, right? In causing hypo or hyperthyroidism. That is definitely a very high yield thing to know for the purposes of the USMLE exams, right? You need to definitely know that amiodarone can cause both hypo or hyperthyroidism. Right now, some of you may be like, okay, Divine, like which one goes with which? Well, the thing is, the Yod-Bisdal phenomenon is when a person gets hyperthyroidism, right? After getting iodine or some kind of iodide ion, right? So it's almost like an iodine-induced hyperthyroidism. That's the Yod-Bisdal phenomenon. On the flip side of things, the Wolff-Chaikoff phenomenon is an iodine-induced hypothyroidism, right? It's an iodine-induced hypothyroidism, right? So Yod-Bisdal goes with hyperthyroidism. Wolff-Chaikoff goes with hypothyroidism, right? Hypothyroidism. Basically, just think of them as opposites of each other. Yod-Bisdal is the opposite of Wolff-Chaikoff, right? Yod-Bisdal is the opposite of Wolff-Chaikoff. And just let me just take one small quick detour here. One very nice way they can test this thing is they can give you a question about a person that becomes like tachycardic, tachypneic, has increased deep tendon reflexes after they just got like some kind of CT study, right? Like some, you know, CT scan with contrast. The thing that's causing that problem is essentially the iodine in the, because remember, contrast contains iodine, right? So that iodinated contrast by way of the Yod-Bisdal phenomenon is causing hyperthyroidism in those people, right? Again, that's very, very high yield to know. That is very, 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 very high yield to know, right? So Yod-Bisdal, hyperthyroidism, Wolff-Chaikoff, hypothyroidism, right? Those are very high yield things to know for the exam, I promise you. They're very important to know for your test, right? So they can cause both hypo or hyper thyroidism, right? Hyperthyroidism, Yod-Bisdal, hypothyroidism, Wolff-Chaikoff. Hypothyroidism, Wolff-Chaikoff. Okay, right? So those are probably like the big things to know about amiodarone for the USMLEs. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient? They tell you that the patient is studying on an antihypertensive. And they tell you that, oh, you know, 3 weeks later, the patient has been noticing like swelling of their legs. That, you know, kind of gets better a little bit at night and stuff like that. Whenever you see stuff like this, I really want you to think of calcium channel blocker, the dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, right? So drugs like amlodipine, felodipine, nicardipine, nifedipine, those are things you definitely want to make sure you know. So the thing is, these calcium channel blockers, right? If you, of all the antihypertensives, they're like the big, big, big ones that tend to cause peripheral edema. That's a classic thing they love to test on exams, right? So how exactly do these drugs work? Well, these drugs are vasodilators, right? Because if you remember, if you look at the vascular tree, right, you know, from these big arteries and all that stuff, you form arterioles. And then after you form arterioles, you form capillaries. After you form capillaries, you form venules, right? Now, here's the thing. The thing is, for the arterioles, right, they are the primary sites that controls your systemic vascular resistance, right? Your arterioles are where you have primary control of your systemic vascular resistance. So the thing is, these arterioles are dilated, right? Because again, these are calcium channel blockers. You need calcium for smooth muscle contraction, right? So if you block these calcium channels with, again, a drug like amlodipine, that's going to cause them to not contract. They're going to relax. And if they relax, they're going to dilate. If they dilate, that's going to reduce systemic vascular resistance. That's going to reduce afterload, right? And if you reduce afterload in those circumstances,
that's obviously going to be a good thing, right? That's definitely going to be a good thing, right? Because that's going to lower the person's blood pressure, right? But the thing with that is, because you're dilating those arterioles, you're sending more blood to the capillaries. If you send more blood to the capillaries, you're going to jack up the hydrostatic pressures in those capillaries. And when you jack up those hydrostatic pressures, you're going to have increased fluid extravasation. And when you extravasate that fluid, then that's going to cause peripheral edema, right? So in general, the way we're going to treat those problems with calcium channel blockers is we can actually dilate those venules. Because again, remember I said you have arterioles first, and then arterioles feed the capillary, and then the capillary is drained by the venule, right? So the thing is, that venule that drains these capillaries, those post-capillary venules, they're dilated by ACE inhibitors. Obviously, if you dilate those venules, then that's going to draw the blood away from the capillaries. That's going to reduce the hydrostatic pressures in the capillaries, and that's going to decrease fluid extravasation, and that's going to fix the peripheral edema. So that's actually a very high yield thing to know for exams. Whenever a person has peripheral edema that's associated with the use of the dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, the drugs of choice for treating that are your ACE inhibitors, right? Your ACE inhibitors, ARBs, they're perfectly fine for those purposes. Right now, it's also very high yield to remember what's going to happen to a person's heart rate if they are placed on a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker. Well, I would really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, these people are going to have a reflex tachycardia. That's very high yield to know. They're going to have a reflex tachycardia. Well, what's the deal with this reflex tachycardia? Well, if you think about it, you take a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, that's going to lower your systemic vascular resistance, right? So if you lower your SVR, you're going to have less pressure on your baroreceptors. So your baroreceptor is going to be like, oh, why is my blood pressure this low? So you're going to speak to the brain, and then your brain is going to be like, okay, we're going to send the sympathetic discharge. So that sympathetic discharge is going to increase the speed of conduction down your AV node. So the person's heart rate is going to go up. You're going to get a reflex tachycardia when you take a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker. Now, it's also very high yield to know for NBME exams that these dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, you generally want to be very smart. I mean, you want to be careful and essentially try to avoid combining them with drugs like sildenafil, right? Remember, that's a vasodilator, or drugs like nitrates. Remember, those are vasodilators, right? Or drugs like alpha-1 blockers like prazosin or terazosin or doxazosin. You want to avoid combining them. Again, whenever you combine two vasodilators together, that can massively increase the person's risk of orthostatic hypotension, right? Orthostatic hypotension. So that's one thing you want to avoid if you can, right? So what are some of the things you may see? What are some other things you may see for these dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers on NBME exams? Well, remember, you can use these drugs for variant angina, right? Prinzmetal's medal angina is going to be a young female that very likely smokes and has chest pain that is worse at night, right? That's a coronary vasospastic problem, right? Her coronary vessels, they're not occluded, they're just vasospastic, right? So you're going to give those dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers to help in those circumstances, right? And remember, these dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers can also be used in hypertensive emergency. Remember, hypertensive emergency is when a person has very high blood pressure. Again, the number doesn't matter. I know that people, again, that's why I feel like some people, their brains are full of things for step 2 CK, step 3. That's not very necessary, right? Like, you see people memorizing all these blood pressure cutoffs. To be honest with you, you probably don't need to know those blood pressure cutoffs for your exam. The key thing to know is if a person's blood pressure is crazy high and they have signs of end organ dysfunction, then in those circumstances, you want to think about hypertensive emergency, right? So what are the drugs you can use in hypertensive emergency? You can use labetalol, you can use nicardipine, you can use clavidipine, and you can use sodium nitroprusside. One that you may consider is phentolamine, right? But that's rarely used on the USMLE exams. So I'll say nicardipine, clavidipine, labetalol, and nitroprusside. Don't use hydralazine for the management of hypertensive emergency. You will get it wrong on your exam, right? So you see these calcium channel blockers I mentioned, these dihydropyridines, clavidipine, nicardipine, those are perfectly acceptable drugs for the management of hypertensive emergency. And then remember, if a person is pregnant, right? Remember, there you cannot give most of the antihypertensives we classically use in pregnancy, right? Because there are many of them are teratogens, right? But remember, nifedipine is a calcium channel blocker that is safe in pregnancy. Remember, there's this mnemonic that hypertensive moms love nifedipine. I'll say that again. Hypertensive moms love nifedipine for the antihypertensives that are safe in pregnancy, right? The H is for hydralazine. The M is for methyldopa. The L is for labetalol. And then the N is for nifedipine, right? Hypertensive moms love nifedipine. Nifedipine is a drug that can be used
is a drug that can be used in pregnancy. In fact, it can be used in OB-GYN in two different scenarios. One scenario is it's used for hypertension in, you know, pregnancy, but another scenario is that you can actually use it as a tocolytic, right? You can actually use it as a tocolytic. So what is a tocolytic? Well, a tocolytic is something that you can use, right? Is something that you can use to delay labor. So when may you want to delay labor? Well, you may want to delay labor in a situation where a person has, you know, let's say they've gone into labor, right? And you're like, wow, this person is at like 28 weeks, 29 weeks. Obviously, that's a premature baby, right? In those circumstances, the thing you want to do on an MBM exam is you want to, one, give a tocolytic to slow down that pregnancy. And then two, you want to give like betamethasone to promote fetal lung maturity, right? Especially if, again, if you're at less than 34 weeks. And then you also want to give magnesium for neuroprotection, right? You're basically trying to cut down on the child's risk of, you want to cut down on the child's risk of cerebral palsy, right? That's if they are less than 32 weeks, right? So that tocolytic is going to basically stop the uterus from contracting. Well, there are two tocolytics you're supposed to use on MBM exams, and you know which one to use by where you are in pregnancy, right? So if you're 30 weeks or less, you can use indomethacin. Indomethacin is the first line tocolytic in people that are 30 weeks or less on MBM exams. But if you're over 30 weeks, you obviously cannot give indomethacin. I mean, indomethacin is a cyclooxygenase inhibitor. It's going to reduce the synthesis of prostaglandins. Well, if you give that, then it sounds like you're trying to close the child's ductus arteriosus, and then the child will die, right? We don't want that, right? So in those circumstances, we're going to use nifedipine. Nifedipine is actually a first-line tocolytic that is used after 30 weeks on MBM exams. That is a very high yield little piece of information to know for exams, right? So again, these calcium channel blockers, right? You can use them on two fronts in OB-GYN. Nifedipine can be used as a tocolytic, and nifedipine is also an antihypertensive that is very safe in pregnancy. And then remember that these drugs, these dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, can also cause constipation. Again, you need calcium for smooth muscle contraction, right? So the thing is, remember, your GI tract is lined by smooth muscle. So if you give a calcium channel blocker, then you're not going to be able to have adequate contraction of your GI tract, right? And that will obviously not be a good thing for these people. It can cause constipation, right? And remember, if they give you a question, let's say they give you a question about a person, and they tell you that, oh, this patient came in with the worst headache of their lives, really, really bad headache. And then they tell you that, you know, you get a non-contrast CT scan of the head and it's negative. Obviously, you're going to proceed after that to a lumbar puncture because you're looking for xanthochromia. And then you notice, wow, that this person's CSF has like 5,000 red blood cells per millimeter cubed. Obviously, that's a ton of blood. This person has a subarachnoid hemorrhage. Remember, a subarachnoid hemorrhage is an example of a hemorrhagic stroke. Now, the thing is, blood is very irritating to the brain. So the thing is, blood can cause vasospasm of cerebral vessels after a person has a hemorrhagic stroke. Well, if you have vasospasm of cerebral vessels, that's obviously not going to be a good thing, right? Because if you're vasospastic, it's almost like you're having Prinz medial angina in the brain. That's not good. If Prinz medial angina can cause an MI, well, vasospasm of your cerebral vessels can certainly cause like an ischemic stroke superimposed on a hemorrhagic stroke, right? So it's almost like you had the hemorrhagic stroke first. And then that hemorrhagic stroke kind of served as a nidus for you to have an ischemic stroke because of the blood that's irritating the cerebral vessels, right? So what is a drug you can give to prevent that post-hemorrhagic stroke vasospasm? That's going to be a calcium channel blocker known as nimodipine, right? That's a calcium channel blocker known as nimodipine. Nimodipine is an excellent drug on MBM exams to reduce the risk of a person having post-stroke vasospasm, right? Because you don't want them, again, to have an ischemic stroke superimposed upon the hemorrhagic stroke that he started off with. Now, remember, these calcium channel blockers, right? There's the dihydropyridine flavor, right? These ones all end in dipine, 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 right? But there's also the non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, right? So the thing is, the dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, they are more specific for blood vessels, right? But the non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers like verapamil or diltiazem, these are more cardioselective. These ones go after the person's heart more, right? So these non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, what are some key things you can see them being used for in exams? They can be used for angina, right? They are one of the first line agents you can use for angina, right? Angina, you know, chest pain that worsens with exertion, gets better with rest, right? Again, usually for people that have angina, you're probably going to do some kind of stress test on them. And by the way, I've made a stress test podcast back in the day, right? But you're going to do a stress test on these people. And then after that, you're going to put them either on a nitrate or a beta blocker or a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker like verapamil or diltiazem, right? And remember, these drugs, because they are cardiodepressive, you also want to avoid them in a person that has acute decompensated CHF, right? If a person has acute decompensated congestive heart failure, you don't want to give a verapamil or diltiazem. That will not be a good thing for those people. Now, remember, verapamil or diltiazem, they can also be used for AFib, right? Again, in a rate control strategy. Remember, rate control for AFib can involve either the use of a beta blocker or you can use a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker like verapamil or diltiazem. And then it's very high yield to know, right, that these non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers can also be used for SVT, right, for supraventricular tachycardia. Remember, that's going to be a narrow complex regular tachyarrhythmia. It's narrow complex because it's from above the ventricle, right? It's from above the ventricle. So that's why it's a narrow complex regular spaces between the QRS complexes are equal. It's a narrow complex regular tachyarrhythmia, right? So the thing is, if a person has an SVT, obviously you're going to try the vagal maneuvers first, you know, massage their carotids, put their head in cold water, tell them to blow into a straw, you know, stuff like that, right? Because again, think about it. If you blow into a straw, right, you're going to be increasing intrathoracic pressure, going to be banging on your baroreceptors. So your baroreceptors are going to be like, ooh, my blood pressure is too high, right? So they're going to speak to the brain, and then the brain is going to send a parasympathetic discharge. And when you send that parasympathetic discharge, that's going to slow down the rate of conduction down your AV node. That's going to lower the person's blood pressure and heart rate, right? So that's a good thing in that circumstance. But if that doesn't work, obviously you're going to proceed to adenosine. We're going to talk about that adenosine in a different podcast, but you know, you're going to proceed to adenosine. But after you put you give them adenosine, usually that's going to abort the arrhythmia. You can't say, oh, okay, given adenosine, problem solved, deuces, bye. No, you can't do that. The person is just going to flip right back into a high heart rate. So usually after that, you've given adenosine, you're going to give either a beta blocker to bring down their heart rates or keep it low, or you can put them on a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker like verapamil or diltiazem. And then don't forget that verapamil actually increases the secretion of prolactin in the central nervous system, right? So the thing is, if a person is on verapamil, or they tell you that a person was recently started on a drug for angina, right, or for SVT, and then you notice that this person is having like gynecomastia, having galactorrhea, right? If you see things like that, or they are becoming infertile, or they're having like low libido, problems like that, you want to think about verapamil-induced hyperprolactinemia, right? You want to think about verapamil-induced hyperprolactinemia. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. I'm almost certain this cardiovascular pharmacology series is going to be the more I think about it, I'm like, it's probably going to be a 3 or 4 podcast series. But let me tell you this. The reason that it's this long is because cardio is something that integrates well with many different disciplines, right? So the thing is, this may be a podcast about cardiopharmacology, but there may be just many other things you're learning, right? Like literally today already, we've talked about thyroid, we've talked about pulmonary fibrosis, we've talked about peripheral edema, we've just talked about like lupus, like just different things, right? So the thing is, as I'm going over this, because I know some of you may be like, this method is a little disorganized, but to be honest with you, it's actually one of the better methods to teach and explain this material, because one, you're learning in context. Two, you're going to be able to see it in an exam mode. Because the thing is, that's one thing many people don't realize is, it doesn't really make sense to learn USMLE material in a linear fashion, right? Where it's like, okay, oh, Divine, organize it for me. Talk about all the beta blockers, mechanism of action, uses, side effects. No, that's why you see I love to use scenarios. And to be honest with you, that's how I teach my course, right? And again, it's just something that's more helpful, because on your exam, they're not going to have a physiology section, internal medicine section. No, that's ridiculous, right? In your first 10 questions, there may be an OB-GYN question thrown in there somewhere, a pharm question thrown in there somewhere, a surgery question thrown in there somewhere, right? So the thing is, knowing those things is just going to help you out a lot more on your exam. So that's why, again, I love to use these scenarios. I just feel like that's the thing that kind of differentiates me from many of the other people you see out there on the market. So Hopefully you found this podcast to be helpful. But again, I promise you, if you listen to like the 3 or 4 podcasts in this series, I'm going to integrate things for you really nicely. And you're going to know them really well for your exam, right? And the thing is, you're going to learn a lot more than just cardiac pharmacology. Again, as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams. Step 1, Step 2 CK, Step 3, preclinical med school exams, third-year clerkship shelf exams. And, you know, if you're a medicine resident, I need tutoring for the medicine in training exam or the medicine boards. I do offer tutoring for those. And then, again, obviously, I have this Step 2 CK, Step 3 course. I'm going to have some Step 1 course offerings. It's probably going to be coming later this year. I'm going to hopefully announce it pretty soon once I get the details and kinks worked out. And then I also help with ERAS applications, right? I do a lot of mock interviews. Again, I've started interviewing a lot of people. Again, you know, I was on admissions committee for a year, so I know a lot of these processes pretty well. You know, many people I've worked with are now in residency in many different specialties, derm, anesthesia, surgery, many different disciplines. So if you need help with those, just shoot me again an email through the website and I'll be more than happy to guide you in the right direction. And then I have a podcast, a new website actually. It's called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Actually, there's a podcast attached to that. It's called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. Yeah, you can look for it on Apple Podcasts. But many people have said, oh, Divine, you know, I love the life lessons you put at the end of your podcasts. I'm still going to be putting some at the end of these podcasts, but I decided to just start a dedicated website, you know, where it's just short podcasts, you know, like 10, 15-ish minutes long, just a lot of Bible-based teaching, you know, just something that relates to a common problem that we face as human beings. You know, let me not say a common problem, common problems we face as human beings. So if you're listening to those podcasts, again, I think that's going to help you. I think I'm on episode 29 of 30 right now. So I'm going to be adding more and more every week. So, you know, just Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. And then, you know, I do have a YouTube channel. Actually, there I have this thing that's going to be coming out soon where I'm going to be making a ton of videos that I'm going to be putting on YouTube. So I'll encourage you actually, sign up for my YouTube channel, subscribe to it. It's called Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. And in that, so I'll say it again, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. Thank you for those that have subscribed. If you subscribe to it, that's where I'm going to be putting and pasting all my videos. And then the other thing I'm going to say is, you know, I have these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, and on Spotify, right? So if that's something you're looking for, again, find the podcast there. You'll find the most recent 150 podcasts. If you're looking for the earlier podcasts, then go to the website, Divine Intervention Podcasts with an S.com, right? And you'll be able to see all the podcasts all the way from episode 1. You can download them there because if you download, I think I'm also pretty sure you can speed them up on the website as well. And, you know, any slides I have for some of my podcasts, you can download them through that medium as well. And then the last thing I will say is if you need longitudinal tutoring, right? So there's this thing I do with people when I tutor them longitudinally all through their, you know, preclinical years of med school, all through their shelf exams. Again, if that's something you're looking for, shoot me an email through the website and I'll give you some more information. So thank you for listening to me. I'll see you in the next podcast. Have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you. Thank you.